Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy.
Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, the show where we help you through the midlife, the menopause, motherhood, and everything in between. In this episode, we're going to be talking about a really big and important issue, how to cope with aging parents. Today, we have Jane Caldwell from Age UK, who supported her own mother, Olivia, through Alzheimer's. And she's going to be answering a lot of the questions you've sent and a lot that Trish and I have to ask as well.
We're also going to be discussing the moment your kids utter the sentence every parent is going to encounter at some point. Can we get a dog? Can we get a dog?
Can we get a dog?
Endless nagging about that one. So how it changes the family dynamic if you do bring a four-legged furry friend into your life, because we both got dogs and we love them.
I have Pixel the Welsh Terrier, who's three.
Yeah, and I've got Bridie the Black Labrador, who's 2.5. We love her. First, though, we're going to be talking about fashion, personal style, and whether or not now it might change as we get older. So, Lorraine, how would you describe your style?
Well, my style's been heavily influenced by my actual job, which is actual fashion. So I have a kind of constant set of advice around me from the lovely stylists and fashion editors that I've got. So it does kind of influence how you dress when you work in fashion. But also as you get older, you're influenced by what fits, what you're comfortable with.
Waistbands.
But also I've been a lot braver. So for years I only wore black because it was good to have a uniform and to be smart, and it made an impact in the room. Whereas now I wear a lot more colour.
Well, you're wearing a very, very lovely colourful. Is that navy, red, white?
Everything.
It's got spots, got flowers. Gorgeous dress. Where's that from?
Dresses are very good. This is Rixo. I'm wearing a dress by a small brand called Rixo. I do look at things like Who, What, Where, which is a great website.
Yeah.
And you can get a sense of how women dress, street style there, and that can influence you. I think your clothes say a lot about you. They tell your story. So don't undervalue that or feel that it's in some way shallow to be spending any time thinking about what you're wearing. And it's a particularly female thing. It's not. They tell your story every day. I think probably when you get older, you should take stock. You should open the wardrobe and think, I should have great joy every morning when I get dressed. This should not be stressful for me. And you, so pick the things you really like. And always, always, particularly now, I think it's very pertinent. Putting things together is the key, isn't it?
It's a bit of an art form, and I think we've both been lucky to work with fashion stylists who do that.
It's a lot of advice. It is a little bit more of a minefield. How do you feel, Trish, about the elasticated waist?
Well, I haven't quite got to the elasticated waist, but I'm definitely...
Nigella wears one.
Does she?
Yeah, she wrote
about it. She wrote about it, so she doesn't mind everybody knowing about it. I think it's... you do have to think about... when you do get a bit wide around the middle, and I just hate stuff touching my middle. So I'm gonna say something here. I like to wear a vest because I hate feel of like denim or fabric.
Like
it's very nice, a nice, not a kind of old granny vest. Very nice,
sort
of silky handrail vest. But I've noticed that I just feel really uncomfortable around the middle. And the thing about jeans, I can't bear it when if they're tight on the legs and then there's a gap around the waist, or they're tight on the waist.
You need to buy very high waisted.
Well,
ones.
I like a trouser jean, and I think that's really.
What does
have
that
you
mean?
Well, they look like a pair of nice trousers.
I think
rather
that's
than.
Ridiculous.
Oh no, it's quite cool.
Is it?
I think it's a bit. Phoebe
Ooh.
Philo, maybe?
Do you?
Yes. Yeah, I don't know. I think it's quite stylish. Well, I hope it is, because I've got... that's what I wear.
I always recommend something that people just roll their eyes when I say
it. Am I about to roll my eyes?
Yeah, you're about to roll your eyes. So school, some of the mums I meet at school will say, oh, God, I don't know what to buy. I've got to get this or I've got to get that. And I will say, well, put yourself a little mood board.
Oh, yes.
Oh, eye rolling.
Yes.
Eye rolling. Just get a little mood board of women... you think.
I haven't got time to do a mood
Yes, you have.
Board.
Yes, you have. You just could easily do it on your phone. Drag and drop. It's really quick. Women you think dress really well, that you like their look. You're about the same height. You're about the same shape. And put it together, you get a sense of sort of what you like and what you don't like. And I think that's a very practical way of doing it.
One of my fashion directors in a former life described my look as well put together, well pulled together, which I thought, well, that's quite uncomfortable. I think she's trying to say, look, you're not fashionable, but you make a good effort. And actually, you're not embarrassing me as my editor. So it's the idea that you've got nice clothes that,
not a top to toe look.
It's the handbag and the shoes and the bit of nice jewellery, I think.
That, and good hair.
With it. Good hair, good hair.
Good nail.
Now it's time to talk to our special guest. Jane Caldwell is the CEO of Age UK East London. Welcome, Jane.
Thank you very much.
We've had so many messages, Jane, from women since the launch of this podcast asking for advice on coping with ageing parents as a very specific topic. And I'm just going to read one of them, actually, which says, my mother came to live with us 5 years ago. She is almost 89 years old and has Parkinson's disease. It's been a massive job caring for mum and arranging everything from healthcare, outings, exercise, incontinence, dentures, daycare centre. At the beginning, I was perimenopausal. My relationship with my mum has changed and I'm the carer, and I feel sad when I look at her now, as she was such a strong, dynamic woman. Now she is so frail and not able to converse like she used to. And I think that's very typical of the experience that a lot of women, midlife women, are experienced. And I know you yourself, your mother was diagnosed with Alzheimer's when you were in your 40s. And did you have any idea what kind of journey you were about to go on with her?
No. And I think Every older person's journey is different, and every sibling and his journey is going to be different as well. So I remember the first time my mother was diagnosed. There was a lot of humour around it.
How old were you then?
I think I was in my late 40s. I was in my mid 40s.
Yeah.
And also actually just going into menopause. So a lot of changes going on for myself. And then having to think about what it really meant. I don't think at the beginning of that journey you can ever know what it's going to...
But looking back, do you think there are things that you've learnt from it that you can share with particularly this lady who wrote in? How would you have done it differently? What have you learnt?
So that's an interesting point. I think hindsight is a great thing. So I work in this area, and I have felt a sort of slightly extra pressure to get things right, to do the right thing. Every time there's a new stage of the illness, or you have to rethink what plans you have in place, you always feel like you're getting it wrong. You always feel very guilty. There's a lot of fear.
You sort of got to live with those feelings, and so understand that that's coming at you.
And understand that there is no perfect way to do this. There's no, everyone's an individual, and the decisions you make, you think are the right ones, and then you look back and you think, actually, in whose interest was I making that decision? Was that a decision?
So that's a good question to ask yourself, I guess, when you're going through it.
Yeah, and we're all human. And also I have a daughter who just started a job. So there were...
Perfect.
And
she was storm at home, of emotions.
So there was a lot of different... and two brothers and a sister as well, who were also involved, quite closely involved with thinking about how to support my mother. And my mum, my mum was an old hippie. She was a Glastonbury, Greenham Common, and yet the things that we were offered were, activities in a day centre where they'd be paying Vera Lynn and...
Oh, that would tip me over the edge.
It was quite a challenge, and there is that challenge of, as you see your parent lose the essence of who you think they are, and how to persuade other people that she's... she's still a person.
As you still remember her. Are there websites, are there books, are there things that you could turn to if you were in this period of your life at the moment as a menopausal, perimenopausal woman?
So there are different areas of support. So some support is, I would say, arm yourself with the factual information as soon as you can.
From your doctor or from...
Yeah, from the doctor. So there are also...
Can you go to the doctor with your parent, with your mum, and say, talk to me as well about it?
You can with your mother's permission.
Right. Okay.
So there's a whole series of things that you can do. So one of them is a lasting power of attorney, which you... Right. The earlier you can do that, the better. And there are two types of lasting power of attorney. One is financial and the other is for your health. I would highly recommend doing those as soon
as... With a solicitor?
You can do them online.
Oh, right. Interesting.
There's a cost.
But worth doing.
It's definitely worth doing. Do it for yourself as well as for other people. Start thinking about all of these things earlier. I mean, it is a classic thing. We're all, if we're lucky, older people in waiting.
Do you think we are all going to die?
Mm-hmm.
Oh God! Did it make you think about your own mortality? I spend a lot of time thinking about my own mortality in midlife because I've do the what they call the death maths on this, on how many summers, how many Christmases, that kind of thing. Did it make you think about your own mortality?
Completely, absolutely.
But you've got to stay perky for your children, haven't you?
Yes. And then, interestingly, trying to have conversations with your children about when you die, then it just becomes very challenging because, of course, as soon as you start talking about this, it's as though you're saying, I am going to die, or I want to, you know, it's very a very fearful subject. There was no ceiling between myself and death. And that's really what it felt like. It felt like you suddenly become unmoored, that you're next, that all of those things. And your end of life becomes tangible to you in a way that it wasn't before. So you've got all that to kind of deal with.
You have to be very respectful, don't you, of your parents' wishes, because I'm going through this myself at the moment with my father, who's 80, who's amazing, but does not want to go to hospital and does not want to interfere. He still thinks he's 18, like we all still think we're 18, but you have to let older people make their own decisions, don't you, even if they're the silliest decisions of all, aren't they?
Yeah.
What is it you say? Let them be stupid if they want to be stupid.
If I look back at my life, many, many times in my life have I made stupid decisions.
Yes.
and it doesn't stop when you get older. And it's really frustrating. I mean, I've got a friend who constantly gets furious at his dad because his dad insists on going up a ladder to the attic. And every time he goes up there, he has an accident. And it's like, well, you know, your father has cognitive ability. He perfectly understands the risks. It's up to him. You can't.
Yeah, you're not his dad.
So we just have to not be frustrated by it. I mean, it's difficult, but we have to, as you say, if you think of them as it's their decision, it's their choice. And you can't then feel guilty and frustrated and worried about it.
No, and an awful lot of time and effort is spent on sort of discussing your parents' inability to make the decisions you want them to make, amongst us as well, amongst my brothers and sisters. We endlessly be talking about, well, I don't think that's a very good idea, and da da da. And actually, whilst they have capacity to make those decisions, they've got every right to make incredibly stupid decisions just like the rest of us do on a daily basis.
And talking about siblings, I imagine it can be a real point of contention because if one person is, you know, if somebody's moved away from home and one sibling has got the main amount of care, or you disagree on approaches, what kind of advice would you give to people about how you deal with a situation like this within the general family dynamic?
Yeah, so it can be very challenging. And of course, it's always at the moment you have to make a decision that you are most overwhelmed by how sad, as your reader said, how angry, the sense of grief and the sense of loss and the sense of responsibility. It's always at those moments when you have to make those key decisions. And that's very often a point where everybody's different reactions to the experience of seeing their parent disappear and then pass away. It's a really profound experience. And I suppose in my situation, I had one brother who was very, very adamant that my mother needed to go into a home, and that was the right thing to do because that's where she would get the care, and we were all being incredibly irresponsible, and that's just the way it should happen. And then on the other side of the spectrum, my other brother, who was, we know how, you know, we've got to keep her at home, and you're being very unsympathetic, and, you know, the main thing with my mother is about preserving her dignity and keeping as much independence as possible. Well, I think it's also understanding where my brother's rigidity came from, which is a fear, really, of not being, of firstly, just the whole tragedy of that,
maybe getting
of Alzheimer's,
it wrong, not being able to care for her properly.
Yeah, yeah. Of just wanting an expert to do it. Yeah. And I think, you know, in hindsight, we made the decision to support my mother into a care home too late. We kept her at home too long. And that's a very individual thing. Everyone will be different.
Is there a better way to talk about, because I have it with my dad as well, the going into the home conversation is just such a dark and terrible. I feel like as a society, we've got ourselves into this dreadful trap of it being the it meaning the end. And actually, is there a better way of discussing going into a different phrase? You know, going on holiday, go, I don't know. It just feels like we've made it this terrible thing and this is the beginning of the
waiting
end.
Room for
the waiting room.
Inevitable.
And actually, yep. Going into a home could be an amazing thing if you get the right home and the right people and the right care. How do we change that?
So that's a really difficult question.
Yeah.
Because for the majority of people, going into a home is I'm afraid to say, a little bit like going into prison. That you, you know, you're at home, you have all your choices when you get up, what you eat, what you watch on television, what books you read, what clothes you're wearing, etc. And for a lot of people, the experience of going into a home is that then suddenly you've all got to get up at a certain time, you have to eat whatever they put in front of you, you're wheelchaired in front of the television.
Yeah.
It can be a very depressing. So I think the answer to that question is the whole care system needs to change. And there are some very interesting developments, different supported environments.
That's what it is, isn't it? A different supported environment.
Where can people find out about that? Is there information on the Age UK website?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So certainly around all of the legal and the practical information, if you go onto the Age UK website, you will find all the practical information. And really, I cannot recommend enough, find out about all your legal rights now. Mm-hmm. Check your things like how much savings your parent has, because all of that will come into play further down the line when you have care costs. Mm-hmm. Also, I would be looking at things like the continuing health care system, which is the next step of the decision you might have to make as a sibling, which is for example, in my mother's case, she was in a care home, and a care home has care workers. It doesn't have clinical staff. It doesn't have nurses. It doesn't have doctors.
Just support work rather than a medical.
Yep, exactly. And there comes a point where their need may be too great for that home, and they have to go into a nursing home.
You've got to think 3 to 4 stages ahead, haven't you?
Yeah, so it's just a good idea to understand that whole journey so that you're prepared at each stage.
So should you be sitting down with your parents while they're compass mentis and having the kind of, we're going to have the chat about when you get older, what do you want, when do you want it, where are your savings, what would you like to happen, which I haven't had and I feel it probably should have had.
But if you don't have that conversation, then you're not going to be aware of what your parents might choose. And it then comes too late. That's the problem.
And they're in a place where they probably can't tell you totally because they're not quite themselves.
Yeah. And I think, I think it's also, if you think about yourself, you know, about what kind of conversations you'd like to have about your own end of life.
Yeah.
It brings it sharply into focus how challenging that is, but how necessary it is. You know, none of us want to die in pain. None of us, you know, particularly want to die in hospital. The majority of us want to die at home, yet most of us end up dying in hospital, for example. So there's lots of...
It's really tough. I mean, my mum unfortunately passed away from breast cancer. She was only 61, so it's a different experience to you. But equally, it was a very, you know, it was a sort of long-term illness, and that was a very difficult thing to go through and to come to terms with. But she was very, she wanted to have a good death, and she was very clear about she wanted to be at home. We sort of Catholics. She wanted, you know, faith to her was a really important part of her sort of letting go. And, you know, so although it was awful for all of us, but she actually was where she wanted to be. She felt comfortable. She had everybody she loved around her. And I think we need to kind of get our heads around this idea of that there is a way to have a good death, isn't there? There is. Yeah. It doesn't have to be this horrific thing that we shy away from, but it's something we just need to start thinking about and preparing ourselves for ahead of.
Yeah. I wonder where in the world they do it differently. I'm probably the Netherlands, I think, or where
Scandinavia.
Scandinavia.
Let's go to Scandinavia.
Yes. Yeah. What do you, from your point of view at work, where do they do death better, happier, more humorously, with more care?
So so some of it is about the cultural way we view older people.
Yes.
So I think the challenge for us in Britain is that we very much view old age as a weakness or an illness or a problem. And so it's, you know, if you look at cultures where they have language like elders, where they have a whole, you know, in Southeast Asia, for example, you know, it's a whole different way of
treasured and prized.
Yeah, exactly.
More valuable to society.
More valuable. And, you know, it never ceases to amaze me that people get frustrated with older people when they're waiting for them in a queue, and all that they take longer
it's
to get on the
unkind.
Bus. Yeah. It's really unkind. Yeah. And it's as if we somehow, when we get older, can avoid being like that, because we're all going to lose some of our abilities.
Yeah, well, but yes. Yeah,
It's just inevitable.
Are there things that you did with your mum that you would advise? I mean, did you take little pictures? A friend of mine said to me, oh, you should sit down and have a chat with your dad and record it and ask him about, he was in the police and all the things he did.
Yes.
And should sit and have a chat with him, go through the whole. I mean, I might cry all the way through that. So that might be a different. Are there little things like that that are poignant and lovely that we could do?
Yes. I mean, there'll be a lot of times when you'll be crying. I think that's fine. So we did things very late, I would say. So in fact, my brother and I did a photo album of my mother's life when she went into a care home, because we were aware that she was going into a home where nobody knew her. People didn't know her
history.
Oh,
so they had its reference of who she was. Oh, that's lovely idea.
So, so it literally took us a long, you know, it took us hours because a lot of the photographs, we didn't know who they were of. And, you know, and that's another thing I'd recommend is go through your family photographs when your parents are able to tell you who everyone is in the photograph.
Yeah, good point.
Because we did it way too late. And I would say it's quite common to feel like you've done everything too late as well. So things like, that was one of the best things I think we did for my mother, which was to give her some personality and to bring that into that care home so that the care workers could look through it when they were sitting with her. And
so she was a real human and they could understand her journey.
Yeah, and so there's things like thinking about favourite music, and you think you know your parents' favourite music, but
you
actually...
don't, do you? How can you?
You don't know.
Unless you
actually ask them.
So put a playlist together.
Exactly. And you don't have to be so specific as to say what would you like played at your funeral, but effectively,
Trish, what would you like played at your funeral? Is it Dancing Queen?
No, I've got my funeral songs, but I'm not going to share those. Yeah, we did that one night when we were a bit drunk with a bunch of friends.
Did you?
I don't quite know why.
Your funeral song.
But it was actually quite jolly.
It's very good. Where have you written that so that we can all find it?
Hopefully, you won't need them anytime soon.
Can I ask you about your relationship with your mother? And, you know, I didn't have this experience with my mother, but obviously there comes a point in dementia and Alzheimer's where your relationship must change. And were you kind of conscious of the point where, dare I say, was there a point where she didn't become your mother anymore? Did you see her as Was there a point where you thought, right, I've lost her, she's gone? Or I don't know how that works.
I think it's a very gradual process. And again, everybody's experience of this illness is different. But with my mother, she would be fine and then would some of her cognitive ability would slip, and then she'd be on a plateau for a while, and then suddenly there'd be quite a big dip. And I think it was probably around 6 years before she passed away that really, I think my mother, a lot of her mannerisms seemed to change quite dramatically, and she seemed to be echoing a lot of mannerisms from her childhood, in fact. So she'd be calling a dog in when we didn't have a dog, but she did have a dog when she was very little. So there was a sort
of... The brain reacting in a different way.
Yeah, the memory changing quite dramatically. And I think it's not only your sense of your mother slipping away, but it's also a sense that their memory of you goes, which has an impact on your own sense of who you are. And I think the way that we dealt with that as a family was to move from expecting something from my mother and actually just thinking, we're just going to show up to make sure she's okay. Mm-hmm. And we sort of lowered our expectations. And that is my experience throughout that whole journey, really, was that every step along the way, you have to go, OK, we're now just going into the care home just to give my mother 30 seconds of dancing to a record on her feet and smiling. And then the process of adjusting to that and then feeling very close. It's because the gap then between that moment and my mother passing away was quite short. And the final thing of my mum passing away and my daughter and I sitting side by side in the hospital corridor, sort of being able to talk about it.
And I guess at that point as well, as we've talked about women in midlife, you are going through something emotional and anxious and physical all at the same time. Yeah. So it's quite a lot to take on when you yourself might, your estrogen levels are very low. Yeah. You might not, may or may not be on the right HRT. So you have to take care of yourself, don't you? I think that's the key, isn't it? You've got to be as healthy as you can to deal with this.
Yeah. And you have to give yourself permission, which sounds a terrible thing to say, but you really do have to give yourself permission to take some time out.
Did you feel guilty when you were doing something different?
I definitely, and I was in a very supportive environment, both at home and at work, really. I mean, I work in this landscape, so
you had knowledge.
My staff were all very supportive. You know, everyone's saying, oh, perhaps you should take some time off. And I'm going, no, I'm absolutely fine. You know, it's fine. I work in the hospital. It's all
silly.
Fine.
And then, I think it's really important that we... You know, my advice looking back is understanding what the grief process is and preparing yourself for that as well, because it hits you like a ton of bricks. Yeah. And, you know, it's that allowing yourself to, you know, your instincts go, oh, no, I'm fine. You know, and actually
distractions, distract myself.
I was when my mum died, I was 3 weeks away from having my twins, which was, so you can imagine, it was a really difficult time. And I just remember this really stupid thing I did, where I bumped into somebody in mother care and she was having a baby, and she's like, oh, how are you? How's everything? Like, yeah, it's all fine. Yeah, getting stuff for the baby. Well, my mum just died, but yeah. You know, and it was just like, I can't believe I said, I went to her, I cannot believe I said that, trying to pretend everything was fine, trying to pretend everything was normal. And it's a long, hard process, isn't it? Yeah. I think. And you need to allow yourself time.
You do.
And space and permission to grieve.
Yeah, you do. And I think it's different for everyone again. But then over a period of time, you get used to not having your mother there. I had a very close relationship with my mother many, many years ago. So I didn't have somebody to call up and talk nonsense with or whatever, you know what I mean? Whereas my friend had that relationship with her mum right up until the moment she died. And it was absolutely devastating for her right afterwards.
Does it make you cherish your relationship with your own children more?
It does, yeah, definitely. I sort of look at her now and I just think, oh, you're going to be going through what I went through with yes. my mother, with
yeah.
me.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, the whole generational thing is so complicated and so different. Mm. I think humour is terribly important. And certainly in my work, what I can see is that the older generation have a really very strong impulse to resist being helped or to...
Yes, yes.
You know, there's a resistance against charity, against feeling that they might need support in any way whatsoever.
Yes, I think my dad, in his recent visit to hospital, wandered off to get a cup of tea because he didn't want... nearly having major heart surgery, didn't want to ask anyone and put anyone to any trouble, and then obviously got lost in the hospital, and there's a kind of APB out for where was he, what was he doing, you know. So they don't want to be helped,
thing,
this, that generation.
There's a pride yeah. thing.
So finally, Jane, if somebody out there is just really feeling overwhelmed by this kind of situation, where can they get help?
So I would contact their local Age UK and they will be able to signpost them on to what support groups there would be in their area, or they may be able to suggest forums for... I mean, I'll give you an example. The other day, somebody sent me a leaflet for... This is going to freak you out. Something called the Deaf Cafe.
Oh, yes, I think I've heard
yeah.
of that.
Oh,
yeah.
my God.
Yeah. yeah. So, and that they can be run by different groups. In my area, a lot of them are run in churches, mm-hmm. but it's just a safe place to go along
and to talk
that's... and to freak out and also to do...
What have you called it? The Deaf Cafe?
The Deaf Cafe.
There's got to be a bit of language around
oh,
that.
Oh, I love it, the Deaf Cafe.
Yeah. Kind of the forever cafe. The Infinity Cafe.
We are all going to die. Yeah. I know, it's like
true.
Even saying
I get
it,
your head
I kind
it.
Of...
Yeah, get your head
yeah,
yeah,
I'm having another hot flush.
So this is the part of the podcast where we normally talk about teenagers and parenting. This week, we're going to change tack and we're going to talk about another member of our family, our dogs, who are very helpful with teenagers and parenting. There's a lot of health benefits, aren't there,
oh,
Trish?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I got a dog 2.5 years ago and first time I've ever had a dog. And we did have the, can we get a dog, you know, from the children from about the age of about 6. And we finally got one when we felt that they were old enough we could leave them at home on their own for an afternoon. And that, you know, so you're not worrying about who's looking after the dog if you've got to go out. And all the chat about, oh, we'll look after it, we'll pick up the poo, not a chance.
No, don't
but it
touch
doesn't
poo.
Matter because Neil and I are obsessed with the dog now.
Yes,
and we
you
love
are.
Her so much. And Neil was particularly resistant and he is, I call her his lady love. Bridie is his lady love now because he's so obsessed with her. He's infatuated with her. She is just, I mean, we'll talk about the benefits of dog. You mentioned health benefits, but I really do feel that I just smile when I see her. And the kids said that as well, that when they come in the afternoon and she's there and waggy tail and a big smile on her face.
Boost to your hormone levels, isn't it?
It really is, yeah.
A lot of the experts in clinical care that I talk to who deal with really troubled teenagers advocate the use of dogs in therapy. I mean, they are obviously used in many ways in therapy anyway, but they de-stress you, so relaxes you on the production of cortisol. They boost the oxytocin. They get you outside. That's the... I mean, yeah. Our dog, Pixel, the Welsh Terrier, little menace that she is, because she chews everything, doesn't come when she's called and barks at everybody. But she is a great leveller when we have to go for a walk. So that thing with teenagers where you should always talk to them side by side, not face to face, or it feels confrontational. Take the dog out, then tackle your big problem. We also use her for resolving arguments. Mm-hmm. So my eldest and I might have a giant tiff, hoo-ha, noisy, bit of shouting. And then I'll think, actually, what my eldest needs now is someone to cuddle her, but I'm still a bit cross and angry.
So you're sending Pixel.
Giving off a vibe. I just open her door and throw the dog onto her bed.
Yeah.
And I can see them in there cuddling.
For me and Neil, it's been amazing because obviously the kids are that age where they don't want to do stuff with us anymore, and we love going for walks and things.
You take
and
Bridie so to the pub, don't you?
We take her for walks, we take her to the pub. So last Saturday, we went to the pub because the 16-year-olds were having a little party at home for the birthday. And I can, honestly, if you want to pull a nice young chap...
Always. It's my goal in life. It's on my bucket list.
Go to a pub with a black Labrador, because they all grew up with them, and they just come over. And honestly, I say this to any sort of young 30-somethings I know who are sort of looking for guys. I'm like, just borrow Bridie and take her down the Alma, and you will be inundated with... Honestly, they just can't resist.
Canine advice.
They are so useful. We talk about dogs being useful, but they can do that as well.
Yes, you should all write in and tell us your dog stories, how they've saved your... family, because I remember we also had a huge argument, all of us, once on a Sunday, and I think it probably would have tipped into Monday morning if the dog hadn't chosen at that point to eat something particularly disgusting under the table and vomit it up in the middle of my white rug upstairs as well. So that brought us all together. Oh. So we'd love to hear your dog stories. Everybody's dog stories are brilliant.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So we're at the part of the podcast where we talk about what's nostalgic for us. We're nostalgia noodling. What's changed our lives and what we're trying out. Trish, is he here as well? Trish,
yes.
What are you looking back on and filled with nostalgia this week?
Well, I've got a few little things. So, something that I'm really loving. I've mentioned before that I'm learning how to sail, and this week's lesson we had to learn about
tie
clouds
up the sailors
and
keep them away from her. No. Empty
we had
the
to learn
seas.
About clouds and meteorology, and it prompted me to look up on Instagram an account called the Cloud Appreciation Society.
Too much time on your hands.
Oh my God, no, honestly. I mean, if you want to kind of love nature and feel, you should see these clouds. It's just stunning. And I'd just say,
what do they do? Well,
they're just all these beautiful shapes, all of these in these stunning locations, and you learn about clouds. And
how does it help you sail?
Well, because of the weather, things like wind, rain, you know, that kind of stuff like that.
So you can read the skies.
Well, not just yet, but I'm trying to learn.
So if I go outside, I can say, Trish, read the skies with me.
And I can tell you if it's an occluded front or not, as the case may
be. We can't talk about my occluded front on podcasts. Thanks very much.
And then what I've been trying is, I'm just going to do another one of my audiobooks, because you know I love an audiobook. And at the moment, I'm listening to Kate Atkinson's latest one in the Jackson Brody.
She's very good,
isn't
she?
God, I just love her. She manages to make... I'm not really big into detective books, to be honest with you, but I love Jackson Brody, and this one's called Big Sky. It's been out for a while, but you've got the lovely Jason Isaacs who plays him in the TV show narrating it, so that's a big bonus. But I love the fact it's got Labradors in there, it's got teenagers in there, it's got all the kind of stuff, and it's very funny, and it's got a bit of a brooding broken detective. And then my nostalgia noodling, because it was the twins' birthday, we were threatening to give them birthday bumps, and they didn't know what birthday bumps were.
What's wrong with them?
Well, when we grew up,
Gen Z are rubbish. They don't know any good stuff.
But we just stopped. I think it must be health and safety. But you know, you used to grab the child at either end and throw them up in the air.
Yeah, bumps.
For the number of times of their birthday. Well, they don't do that anymore.
What do they do?
They do birthday beats where they get punched in the
arm. I don't like that.
I think the bumps might be a little
bit.
Bring back
the bumps.
Bring back the bumps.
We should get a bumper sticker.
Yeah, bring back the bumps. What about you, Lorraine?
Well, on the nostalgia front, I was cleaning the kitchen drawer and found some baby teeth
pot. In the kitchen drawer.
I know, a little bit macabre. But as it turns out, everybody keeps their baby teeth. Mm. I mean, I've got lock of hair.
I've got hair.
I've got first toy.
Oh.
Actually.
I know a little soft
yeah,
toy.
Teddy that we yeah. put in the newborn's little Moses basket. But I don't, I'm just looking at the teeth. But then, so what is the etiquette? Because I was going to throw them away, and then, but I couldn't bring myself to throw them away.
I don't
Would you
know.
Throw away?
Bury them.
Bury them.
Bury them.
Necklace.
Throw them away. Earrings, a matching necklace.
Earrings.
I don't know.
Anyway, so they're just sat there. I don't know what to do with them. Can I tell you what's changed my life this week? Which is a bit nostalgia noodling as well, actually. Calinetics.
Oh, gosh.
Do you remember that?
I do. I had a video.
So, 1984, they looked 10 years younger in 10 hours. It's a sort of form of gymnastics, Pilates.
It's a bit like
ballet.
Pilates, I think.
Yeah, I went to a class, a calinetics class, just drawn by the fact it was 1984, possibly one of the happiest years of my life. Mm. And actually, it's really good for you because it's a bit more sweaty than yoga and things. And the next day, I couldn't walk down the stairs, and I thought, well, it must be working. Must be working. And the other I'm going to mention a book this week, which I'm trying, is which I think will change my life. And it's a book by Miranda Sawyer. And I've just interviewed her for a festival that we were at. We were talking about this. And the book is called Out of Time. And it's basically about what happens when you hit 40, which is a lot of what we're talking about. And it tackles the bit, you're not melancholy, I am quite melancholy. Mm. So it tackles the death maths, which is when you start to think about how many summers, how many Christmases, all the kind of rites of passage moments that are beginning to disappear. And then you think, well, what am I going to do? How am I going to mark this? Time is going so fast. But it's actually very good on bringing you back and saying, so enjoy the moment, be in the moment, love the moment, don't think about it. So Out of Time by Miranda Sawyer is, I would advise buying that.
So that brings us to the end of this episode of Postcards from Midlife. Thank you so much for listening. We really enjoy all your reviews that you've been posting, so please do rate and review it. And I'm just going to read out one here because it's so nice. It says, just a quick message to say that I am loving your podcast. After listening to you on Chris Evans, I subscribed and have now listened to them all. They are so enjoyable, funny and full of great advice.
I like the two-word review. Ridiculous Twaddle.
Yes, we like that one.
Really big shout out to whoever wrote Ridiculous Twaddle. Do you think it's one of my teenagers?
It could be. It could be.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.